You're listening to Bible Prophecy Daily, a weekday podcast where Bible prophecy matters and matters greatly.
So I want to address two issues today. One is demonstrating that the context in Matthew 24 clearly teaches that the taken there refers to, it's a positive taken, it's a taken to deliverance. And to my knowledge, I have not had not one single pre-tribulationist respond to my specific argumentation. I just haven't. Let me clarify something. Pre-tribs are confused on this issue. They can't even agree on this issue. You have some pre-tribs who believe that it's taken to judgment and some who don't. So they're kind of divided on this issue. And then you have amillennialists who, again, this is a critique against amillennialists who also think that those who are taken to judgment. Those who are left, you know, are the righteous. And even post-tribulationists, most post-tribulationists believe, I shouldn't say most, they're kind of divided on this issue as well, but you often see post-tribulationists argue that those who are taken to judgment instead of righteousness. In fact, there's one post-trib article that I saw, this is maybe last year, the article was entitled, "I Want to Be Left Behind." And I'm like thinking, no, you don't. You don't want to be left behind, because if you're left behind, you will receive judgment. And so what is going on here is that they're making a knee-jerk reaction against the Left Behind series, because obviously Left Behind is, they also believe, and rightly so, by the way, they believe that the text in Matthew 24, those who are left behind are left for judgment. And so there's a knee-jerk reaction against that, you know, somehow trying to distance themselves from that. But in this show, a half a dozen arguments showing that those who are taken are the illustrations, the parables are illustrating the whole point of the event in Matthew 24, which is in verse 31. It's the elect who are taken. The elect are gathered. They're not left behind. They're gathered, right? Jesus comes to the sky. And anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I will cover those points in a moment. Okay, so Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, and Matthew 25, of course, this is Jesus' extended in time teaching. And all too often, everything, or beginning in verse 36, from the preceding discourse, they love to disrupt the cohesion of it. And for an obvious reason, they have a tradition to maintain. They have presuppositions they have to uphold. So if we call up to verse, 36, actually technically that probably, I guess you could say verse 31, you have a narrative, okay, from verses 4 to 31. Is basically, you can summarize as Jesus saying, this is what's going to happen. And then after verse 31, Jesus begins to illustrate, to give application to what he just finished. I mean, pre-tribs would never do this with Paul's teaching, right? Paul often, he'll give doctrinal teaching and then he'll give the application, right? Well, here, the exact same thing is going on in Matthew 24. Up to verse 31, Jesus gives a narrative teaching, and then he gives a spiritual application in verse 32, basically saying, be ready. But he employs different illustrations and parables, and yet it's amazing. It really is amazing to watch this, that pre-tribs will disconnect everything that comes after 31. After 31, sometimes it's verse 36 and onwards from what Jesus teaches. It's truly amazing the disruption they make of the unified text here. And so one of the illustrations that Jesus makes about his return is invoking Noah. And he gives an agricultural illustration as well. Beginning verse 37, I'll just read this. Actually, I'm going to read verse 36 because this is often missed as well for contextual reasons. It says, "But as for that day and hour, no one knows it." Okay, what day? Verse 36, "But as for that day and hour, no one knows it." What day? Again, just look back a couple verses, you know, verse 31, there it is. The return of Jesus, okay, in the clouds. That's the day. And no one knows it, not even the angels in heaven except the Father alone. Okay, so we have that day. This is the context. The context is the return of Jesus here, right? All right, then verse 37. Oh, and by the way, what happens on that day? What did Jesus just finish discussing on what's going to happen on verse 31 or on the day of his return? A separation. There's going to be a separation. Jesus emphasized this separation, okay? And guess who gets separated? The elect. The elect are taken. Matthew 24, verse 31, I want to ask pre-tribulationists, what part of gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other, don't you understand? It is very clear there, okay? There's a separation. When Jesus returns, there's a separation. The elect, God's people, the righteous, they are gathered. They are taken. They are gathered. All right? Jesus could not make it more explicit. And yet we'll see pre-tribulationists completely turn that on its head, that event right on its head. So Jesus just finished saying that the elect are going to be taken, and then he says this. Okay, verse 37, "For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man." The Greek term there is parousia, okay, which refers back to the parousia in verse 27, which, of course, the lightning, the sign occurs in verse 31. Verse 38 says, "For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming." So notice what I'm doing here. I am walking through the text. Again, pre-tribs cannot walk through a text without importing something or having or exporting, actually, exporting back to some secret rapture, pre-trib rapture before verse 4 or whatnot. But it's important to walk through the discourse to discern the narrative contextual flow. And when one does that, they take that approach, they should conclude that the Noahic and agricultural illustrations are referring back to the separation event of the second coming in verse 31. And there's no other coming in that context. That is the coming in focus. So when Jesus begins to employ illustrations, analogies, parables, to refer back to his coming, that is the coming in view. And we know explicitly in verse 31 who are taken. It is the elect of God. So in my episode, I gave six reasons why taken is a positive action and left is a negative action, not the other way around. Those who are taken are not taken in judgment, and those left are not the righteous. Those who are taken, this is going to be a positive action, and those left, again, a negative action. So what are these six reasons? Well, the first reason I already went over, and that is, again, the Noahic and agricultural illustrations in verses 37 to 41, they intend to illustrate the separation of the elect from the wicked at the parousia in verses 30 to 31. Okay, already made that. As far as I'm concerned, that's the most important reason. So in verse 31, you have a separation. And then right after verse 31, you have Jesus illustrating separations. I mean, again, it's mind-boggling to see how pre-tribs build this brick wall between verse 31 and the illustrations that Jesus gives. Okay, the second point here is that the parallelism is consistent among the illustrations as well as the parousia separation event. There's a parallelism in this. And again, you know, go back to verse 9 and I unpack it. The order in which Jesus gives the illustrations is parallels the order as we see as in the illustrations as well. So again, I was just referring to episode 9. I'm not going to unpack it, everything I mentioned in episode 9. But the second reason is the parallelism is consistent. Pre-tribs break that parallelism. Okay. The third reason is the usage of the Greek words paralambano and ero support that the taken are for deliverance and the left for judgment. So the terms themselves, this is a paralambano, this is a positive meaning of taken, where ero is a negative in the sense of being left for judgment, an examination of those the meanings of those words in the context indicates that. Number four, the usage of the Greek word paralambano and the other term there, aphemi, support that the taken are for deliverance and the left for judgment, aphemi. Okay? Those who are left. Again, I unpack the meanings of these words and pre-tribs, they don't touch it. They don't touch this stuff because they have a presupposition. So this is—it's very difficult to get around this lexical, linguistic evidence. So that's why they have to invoke things into the text or take the text out and put it somewhere else. Number five, I mentioned this is a good point too. The parable of the 10 virgins is consistent with the point that the one is taken for deliverance and one left for judgment. If you read the parable of the 10 virgins, you see what's being conveyed there is that those who are prepared are taken. They're not left behind. They're not shut out. They're taken. That's another good point. The consistency here of the illustrations illustrating back to verse 31, the separation. And incidentally, in Matthew 25, verse 6, it says, but at midnight, there was a shout, behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him. I find it very interesting that the Greek term behind that, to meet him, is apontesis, which is the exact same term that Paul uses of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 17. Paul uses apontesis in conjunction with the rapture of God's people, which that doesn't surprise me. In my book, Antichrist Before the Day of the Lord, I have a chart in the appendix showing there are 30 parallels that Paul is drawing from Jesus' Olivet Discourse for his teaching on the second coming. Whenever I hear pre-tribs, they kind of dismiss this. They say, well, there's a few similarities between Paul's, you know. No, there's 30 of them. That's different than just a two or three similarities between these accounts. There's 30 parallels. It's not surprising because Paul himself in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, Paul himself says he got this from the Lord himself. Of course, it would have been a tradition handed down to Paul, the Olivet Discourse tradition. And so you have Paul drawing not just parallel or conceptual parallels, but actual language, apontesis. He draws that as well. And these are arguments that I made in my book, Antichrist Before the Day of the Lord. In fact, it's on page 218. It's endnote 27. It's one of my longest endnotes in the book. Where I recap all these points. Okay, the sixth reason I gave was that Jesus' use of the vulture proverb in Matthew 24 and we're going to see in Luke 17 is consistent with the point that one is taken for deliverance and one is left for judgment. the proverb is, you know, in verse 28, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And in my book, I've made the point that this is a really nice structural verse or structural, it's a structural proverb placement of this proverb, because it indicates judgment, I believe, in terms of what comes before verse 28 is all about man's depravity, and then what comes after 28 is divine judgment. And also, I think there's another meaning of this proverb, and which makes sense because it comes off of verse 27 where Jesus talks about the visibility. You're not going to miss the return of Jesus. It's going to be visible, universal. And the meaning of this proverb is also likely that people will no more miss the presence of the Son of Man when he returns, and vultures will miss the presence of corpses. So getting into his critique of the pre-wrath interpretation, in his section, in his paper, One Taken, the Other Left, what he does is he cites, first of all, he cites Robert Van Kampen's discussion on this on page 295 of his book, The Sign. Okay, so he quotes Van Kampen, which is the same view that I take, that those who are taken to deliverance, that i.e. the rapture, and those who are left for judgment. Okay. And then he says, this is what he says. He says, the assertion that Matthew 24 includes a reference to the rapture of the church is essential to pre-wrath theology. And the notion that the one taken, one left passages speak of the rapture permeates pre-wrath literature. And this is what he says. This is what it says. Quote, this is what Jim McLarty says. Quote, and yet it's an utterly untenable position. I'm going to repeat that now. He says, and yet it's an utterly untenable position. And then he says, I'm not basing that statement on my own preferences or prejudices, but on the text itself. Now, I'm going to repeat this all again, right? Because you're going to see why I'm repeating Jim McLarty on this. He says, and yet it's an utterly, that is, the pre-wrath position is an utterly untenable position. I'm not basing that statement on my own preferences or prejudices, but on the text itself, end quote. Now, I find it very ironic that here I gave contextual arguments, I gave linguistic, lexical arguments, literary arguments, I compared scripture with scripture, I focused on the context in Matthew 24. Okay, now, next he writes, he says, Van Kampen parenthetically references Luke 17, chapter 17, 34 to 36. That's the parallel passage to the Matthew citation. And then he reads the text in Luke 17, 34 to 36. Let me go ahead and read that. It says, I tell you, on that night, there will be two men in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. There will be two women grinding at the same place. One will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other will be left. That's Luke 17, 34 to 36. He says, but the passage doesn't stop there. The conversation between Jesus and his apostles continued. In answering, they said to him, this is Luke 17, 34, in answering, they said to him, where, Lord? And he said to them, where the body is, there also will the vultures be gathered. So, and then he says, McLarty says, now we know why Van Kampen only cited the first three verses and truncated the fourth. It undermines his contention and his position. But that's not dealing honestly with the text. You know, whenever you have pre-tribs cite passages, you better double check their citations. I actually turned to page 295. Robert Van Kampen was talking about specifically the context of one being taken and the other left. He was not talking about the entire discourse. You see, Mr. McLarty assumes that verse 37 is not related to the entire discourse. The whole discourse begins in, let's see, verse 21, or actually verse 20, you could say, verse 20. the reason Van Campen doesn't cite verse 20 to verse, 33, all those, 10, 12 verses, is because that's not what he's specifically talking about in this context. He is talking about the one taken and the other left. So Van Campen, Mr. McLarty, was not being dishonest, and you need to, you know, be more careful in citing sources because you're importing into the intentions of Mr. Van Campen something that is not there. Now, we're going to get into verse 37 definitely because I believe that Mr. McLarty grossly misunderstands that. Well, anyway, he continues. He says, well, Jesus was not referring to those, quote, taken to be with the Lord at the rapture when he comes. Actually, he was. He was, as I demonstrated, that Mr. McLarty would not address. He was speaking of a gathering of people. This is what McLarty writes. He was speaking of a gathering of people to the place where the carrion birds would eat their flesh. Now, this is what he says again. He was speaking of, that is Jesus in Luke 17, he was speaking of a gathering of people to the place where the carrion birds would eat their flesh. Okay, so he makes this assertion, right? So what does he do to back up this assertion? Moves away from Luke 17 and he goes to Revelation 19. So, and then he says, so I'm expecting, okay, Mr. McLarty makes this assertion. How is he going to see get this from the context? And he doesn't. He goes right to Revelation 19. He says, we see that prophecy fulfilled in Revelation 19. And then he's making a categorical error here. He's taking a proverb, right? This is a proverb that Jesus is making. And of course, it connotes judgment. And then now he applies it to Revelation 19, 11, 18 as if that's when this action happens. Because in, let's see, Revelation 19, there's a mention of birds that will eat the flesh of the kings. This is a very common imagery, and you're making it into some technical term. Again, you're confusing categories. You're taking a proverb here that Jesus is referring to his return, okay, and you're importing it into Revelation 19, the Battle of Armageddon, and something happens at the end of the judgment of God, not at the beginning of the judgment of God. The context in Luke 17 as well as Matthew 24, the context, Mr. McLarty, is the beginning of judgment. And you're importing this for in the context that is at the end of judgment. Again, you're making bad contextual analysis here. Okay, so let's move on. He says, despite Van Campen's claim that, quote, the meaning of this passage in this context clearly is that those who are taken to be with the Lord at the rapture, that's not clear at all. Simply insisting on something does not make it so. Yeah, that's right, Mr. McLarty. Insisting something does not make it so. So engage the pre-wrath argumentation. You're the one making the assertions. You're the one going outside of the text. Stay in the text and give us some arguments. And stop making categorical errors. Stop importing other contexts back into this text. And then he says, according to the scripture reference in the book, in the back of his book, despite writing 521 pages, Van Campen never once addressed or cited Luke 17:37. And your point is what? By the way, I'm going to be addressing it here. He referenced Luke 17 a total of 7 times. He even cited Luke 17:34 to 36 4 times, but in every case, he avoided the verse that would undermine his theory. Actually, verse 37 supports the pre-wrath, and I find it ironic that you think, Mr. McLarty, that verse 37 supports pre-trib. And again, we're going to see in a moment that's just simply not the case. Now, Mr. McLarty then shifts to a critique in my book. He says, a similar act of avoidance occurs in Alan Kirshner's book, Antichrist Before the Day of the Lord. This is what I write. In conjunction with Jesus explaining the sign, he ominously utters the proverb, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather, Matthew 24:28. This verse is related to what came before it and what comes after it. It is a pivotal structural verse in that it distinguishes two epochs of human history, conveying the principle that where moral corruption exists, divine judgment is required. When the world's depravity has reached full to the brim, God's eschatological judgment will begin. This comports with the narrative structure of Matthew 24, because everything preceding verse 28 describes moral corruption. Everything that follows, it describes divine judgment. In short, the proverb serves as a warning that the day of the Lord's judgment will begin when Christ returns. And then I make the note that there's an additional there may be an additional point of this proverb as well. People will no more miss the presence of the Son of Man when he returns, and vultures will miss the presence of corpses. In other words, Jesus' return will be obvious. That's on page 69 of my book. And then he says, so in response, he says, McLarty says, by regulating Jesus' words to a mere proverb, Kirshner avoids the future physical reality that would undermine his argument. All right, first of all, it's not a mere proverb. It's a proverb, but it's not a mere proverb. Apparently, Mr. McLarty has a low view of expressions and proverbs and whatnot. Proverbs, they're powerful. In fact, they have more power than even literal language. More impact. And so it's not a mere proverb. It is a proverb, Mr. McLarty. If you're denying it's a proverb, then you're definitely reading scripture in some hyper-literalistic fashion. But this is a proverb, and there's a reason why proverbs have much more impact on readers than just mere, literal language. And then he says, Kirshner avoids the future physical reality. I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. During God's judgment, there's going to be dead bodies and all that, obviously there's going to be vultures, I'm not denying that. What I'm saying here is the point with Jesus invoking the proverb is Jesus is stressing the idea that his presence will not be made. And again, unlike McLarty, I'm actually going to walk through the text. He has not done this yet. He hasn't done it in Matthew 24. He hasn't done it in Luke 17. I will in a moment here. And then he says, let's see here. Jesus did not identify the birds gathering to the corpses as anything other than a prophetic statement. Again, we're going to see why Jesus invoked this proverb. He says, and the notion that birds feasting on dead bodies actually means that the return of Christ will be obvious because vultures don't miss the presence of corpses is fanciful at best. No, it's not actually. Why? Again, you're making assertions, Mr. McLarty. Let me get this straight. So Jesus, in Matthew 24, verse 27, all right, Matthew 24, 27, for as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. And then immediately he says, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So, Mr. McLarty, how again is that fanciful? It's called context. It's called context. Jesus just explained. He just explains that you're not going to miss the presence of the Son of Man. And then he invokes this proverb saying that wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. In other words, vultures don't miss corpses. It's not fanciful, Mr. McLarty. It's called context. And then he says the fallacy of Kirshner's assertion that Matthew 24, verse 28 is a mere proverb would be undermined by simply cross-referencing Luke 17, 37. According to the scripture index in the back of his book, Kirshner never references Luke 17, 37. Yeah, it wasn't my purpose. I have one of the longest endnotes in my book. I address this whole issue of one taken and one left behind, and he doesn't touch it. Now think about that for a moment. Then he says on page 128, while attempting to prove that the rapture and God's wrath happened back to back, he cites Luke 17, verses 28 to 35, but verse 37 is conspicuous in its absence. And so is verses 22 to 27 is absent in that context as well. That's because it wasn't my purpose. I was focusing on the parallel passage in Matthew 24, showing that the back-to-back day of the Lord, or rapture, and the day of the Lord's judgment. And then he says, for both, he wraps this up, for both Van Kampen and Kirshner to miss the most pivotal explanatory text on the topic of one taken, one left, I can only surmise that the omission is purposeful. That sort of failure to properly handle all the pertinent texts leaves me less than convinced that I should adopt the position. Mr. McLarty, you have an incredible prejudice. First of all, you don't even address the arguments in Matthew 24. And then you don't even really explain the verse 37. It's so ironic. Your whole criticism is that I don't explain verse 37, and yet you don't explain it in this context. I mean, you'll reference Revelation 19, but don't actually explain the context there or the connection. So you don't address my arguments. You don't address the context of verse 37 in its context, and you make a bunch of assumptions. So now I'm gonna be addressing verse 37, something that you have failed to do. I am going to actually address it in its context here now. Oh, and incidentally, all Mr. McLarty had to do is search on my website for verse 37, and he would have found it. It's not missing there. It's there for all the world to see. And he does not actually address it. Okay, so let me read Luke 17, 22 to 37. It says that, actually, we could even go back to verse 21, even earlier than that. But let's just begin in verse 22. And he said to the disciples, "The days are coming when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say to you, 'Look there,' or 'Look here.' Do not follow out or follow them. For as the lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the earth, to the other, so will the Son of Man in his day. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, being given in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating, drinking, buying, selling, planting, and building. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So it will be on the same on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let the one who is on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to take them away. And likewise, let the one who is in the field not turn back." And then verse 32, "Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to preserve his life will preserve it, but will lose it. But whoever loses his life will keep it. I tell you, in that night there will be two in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. There will be two women grinding together. One will be taken and the other left." And then verse 37 says, "And they said to him, 'Where, Lord?' He said to them, 'Where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather.'" Okay, the first thing you have to note is, is a lot of pre-tribs will say that the question, "Where, Lord?" The disciples, now remember, everything up to verse 35, this is the Jesus teaching, the whole discourse. And then verse 37, you have a question from the disciples. And pre-tribs are notorious for assuming that verse 37 is only related to verse 35. They're responding to Jesus' whole text. What is Jesus talking about? He is talking about separation and the visibility of not missing his return. But you know, for the sake of the argument, let's assume that the question, "Where, Lord?" the disciples are asking the question about the one that will be taken and the other left, okay? So pre-tribs assume that the question, "Where, Lord?" is, they're assuming that it's referring to those who are taken because they think it's taken to judgment. But it never dawns on them that it is that why can't the question refer to those who are left? Where are they left, Lord? Pre-trib just says that it's like a knee-jerk reaction to just assume that it's referring to those who are taken. But look at Jesus' answer. Jesus' answer is really insightful. It says, "Where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Okay, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Notice it is indicating those who are left. The vultures are not taking the corpse anywhere. They're going to the corpse. They're going to what is left. So this last verse, verse 37, containing the disciples' question of where, is very insightful. And because Jesus' answer that the dead bodies attract vultures. And so you have a judgment imagery representing the ungodly, not the righteous. So this comports much better with those who are left for judgment, not those who are taken for deliverance, contra the pre-trib view on that point. So, again, the question of where, Lord, all right, you have to look at what Jesus answers. And it makes no sense for the where, Lord, to be referring to those who are taken, but where are they left? And Jesus' answer confirms that with the imagery of a corpse that is left. The corpse is left, okay? And not just corpses are left, but look at the second point, the second part of the proverb. The vultures will gather. The vultures go to the corpse. All right, those who are left. So this comports with, again, my arguments from Matthew 24 as well. And here, of course, in Luke's parallel account. But I think actually even a more likely answer to this or under interpretation of this verse is, again, is looking at the whole discourse. The question of where, Lord, I think actually it's more plausible to even see it at the larger discourse level, because Jesus just finished, he just finished talking about his return and the visibility of the return. Yeah, verse 23, you have language of location, right? Look there, do not go out or follow them. And then verse 24, for as lightning flashes and lights up to the sky from one side of the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day. And then he talks about the separation that's going to happen. And then it concludes with the response from the disciples is, you know, where, Lord? And in essence, Jesus is basically saying that's an irrelevant question. The focus is not on where. I mean, he's basically saying you're not going to miss it. That's the whole point. You don't have to ask where. The reason why you don't have to ask where is this going to happen is because it's going to be unmistakable. And so that's why I believe that he invokes the idea of the where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So let me just summarize these latter two points. Number one, if someone wants to argue that the question where, Lord, refers to the question verse 37 refers to verse 35, okay, well, still, you can't get a pre-trib interpretation out of that because, once again, as I made the point that the where, Lord, is much more likely to refer to those who are left, not taken, because of Jesus' answer. The corpse, where the corpse is, corpses are left behind, okay, right? And not only are they left behind, but the vultures go to it. And then, of course, the second point I made was that if the disciples' question, where, Lord, which I'm more inclined to think that it refers to the larger discourse, not just to verse 35, the larger discourse of Jesus teaching the where. The where is, you know, the as it's going to be unmistakable, it's going to be universal. And basically, Jesus' question is, you know, listen, I just explained that it's going to be unmistakable. Lightning is going to contrast with the false messianic claimants, and that the question where, in short, basically Jesus is saying, listen, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. In other words, it's going to be unmistakable. The burden of proof is on the pre-tribber to demonstrate that this proverb, and that's what it is, it's a proverb, all right, that somehow this argues for the righteous being taken. There is no linguistic, there is no contextual connection between this proverb and the conclusion that those who are taken are taken for judgment. Instead, those who are taken, as I demonstrated in the first part of this program, they are taken for the right, the righteous are taken, and those who are left are left for judgment. And verse 37 is actually a very strong argument. This is why I find it ironic that McLarty thinks we're avoiding this verse, where this verse is actually very strong. This verse argues, verse 37 argues for the pre-wrath conceptual interpretation that those who are taken for to be delivered, and those who are left, those who are left for judgment. The location of judgment, the return of Jesus, all that, again, it's going to be unmistakable. It's going to be as plain as day. And you're not going to have to figure out, where is, did the Lord return or not? No, no one's going to have to be asking that question when it happens.
Thanks for listening to Bible Prophecy Daily. We hope you learned something valuable today. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode.